The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with The China Project. Subscribe to Access from The China Project to get access to not only our great daily newsletters, but all the original writing on our website at thechinaproject.com. We cover everything from China's fraught foreign relations to its ingenious entrepreneurs, from the ongoing repression of Uyghurs and other Muslim peoples in China's Xinjiang region to Beijing's ambitious plans to shift the Chinese economy onto a post-carbon footing. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. We cover China with neither fear nor favor. A reminder that if you like this podcast, subscribers get an ad-free version of the show every Monday. That's 4 full days before the public release. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Joining me is my good friend Jin Yumi, president for life of the Nashville chapter of the Jiang Zemin fan club. And my condolences if this latest, I think it's like the 19th report or rumor of his passing, turns out this time to be true. Anyway, yeah, condolences, man. Jeremy, greet the people, won't you?
Kaiser, if you believe that the dearest elder, the Toad King, has died, I don't really know what to say except that you are too simple, too naive.
Me and Justin Trudeau, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, today we are very pleased to have as a guest Yuan Yang, a reporter for the Financial Times, now based in London, but who for many years was stationed in Beijing. Yuan now covers the China-Europe relationship, and that will be the focus of our conversation with her. Yuan Yang, welcome to Seneca at last.
Yes, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
A warm welcome to you, Yuan. Before we jump in, maybe you could tell us a bit about yourself. You were born in China and spent your early childhood there, but moved to the UK while still quite young. Is that right?
That's right. I was born in China. I lived with my grandparents, who are from the southwestern province of Sichuan, until I was 4 years old. And then I came with my parents to the UK. And they were part of this wave of early 1990s students and academics who were trying to basically get as far away from China as possible.
The feeling is familiar. So how did you make your way into journalism? And what has your focus as a reporter been over the years?
My path into journalism has not been straightforward. So I studied economics. The first thing I did, more or less after university, was in the campaigning world, actually. I set up an NGO called Rethinking Economics, which tries to improve economics education. And from there, I went into economics journalism and then into China journalism. And I've always loved writing and storytelling ever since I could write. And I remember very clearly when I learned to write English at the age of 6, it was all kind of Beatrix Potter-esque books, short stories about rabbits and small farmland animals. I don't know if you're familiar with the grand tradition of Beatrix Potter we have in Northern England.
And my
grandparents were quite influential in, I think, that love of storytelling, because there was such a strong oral storytelling tradition, folk storytelling tradition, that they really emphasized. So to cut a long story short, I became a journalist with the FT in 2016 and was posted to Beijing, where I covered the economy and then the technology sector, and then became the deputy bureau chief, took care of the bureau during the COVID years, and I moved back to London a few months ago in the summer.
Ah, okay. I really started to take notice of your writing during your time as the tech reporter at FT. I had a keen interest in that, of course. That was about, 6 years ago. And you had quite a good run there, I think. I thought you really got it. And you had some, I think, very original angles that were quite different. The take that was pretty refreshing compared to a lot of the reporting that was coming out of China at that time. Can you talk about some of the pieces from that period that you were particularly proud of or that you found maybe really challenging to report out?
Yeah, and can I tell you how I became the tech reporter, which is itself a bit of a happenstance story?
Oh, for sure.
I walked into the bureau one day and I said to my colleague, our then deputy bureau chief, Lucy Hornby, who has done amazing reporting on corporate scandals in China.
Oh, yeah. I love Lucy.
We all love Lucy. I said to Lucy, have you seen what's happened to the price of Bitcoin? It's crazy. And this is during, this is around 2016, 17, the Bitcoin price explosion. At the time was considering, I will not confirm or deny, whether I used it to get pound sterling into China. But I was you know, curious about this and many other internet subcultures. And Lucy was like, Yuan, if you care about that kind of stuff, you should just write about it. And I think it was a marker of, I think, maybe generational shifts in newsrooms in terms of attention to consumer tech in particular, and interest in tech issues. Because at that time in 2016, even though, of course, you know, we know, and particularly in hindsight, the huge explosion in China's internet tech giants, Alibaba and Tencent and so on, it was not a major story then, I would say, in the news. And it became a really major story for the next few years. What I want to emphasize there is that the rise of consumer tech in China, and particularly the internet giants, was a story that I think, you know, hit many by surprise, because for a long time we were covering Chinese companies not thinking of them as stories in their own right, in terms of their own success and their own scale. And China's tech giants, be that Alibaba or Huawei, I think really changed the story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, 2016 to me was really the inflection point. It was the moment when we went from sort of dismissively regarding Chinese tech companies as just mere copycats, incapable of anything really original, to suddenly realizing, oh my God, they're
eating our lunch.
Yeah. I think the theme that I've covered in various different stories is about trying to uncover the dysfunction that's often within the Chinese system and within Chinese tech policy. Often we hear the opposite, which is Western commentators overemphasizing the successes of the Chinese system and its technological achievements in terms of control. So, for example, one story I did during the pandemic was looking at the ways in which lots of different data gathering and surveillance efforts within the government were not joining up, because different provinces were not sharing the data with each other, meaning that they weren't tracking people potentially carrying the virus when they moved over provincial borders. Different agencies have always tried to kind of hog data for themselves and not had the incentives to be generous with sharing with other departments. Sometimes they can't share it just because of basic differences in the way that they format and arrange the data. And so while there are obviously huge ambitions in the Chinese government to be able to surveil and to be able to make all data cohesive, those efforts are really very piecemeal and very difficult to enforce. So I always try in my reporting to try to paint both the kind of successes, but also the failures of Chinese technological policy. And I think that's a much more objective view than to be overly excited about the successes of what is from afar seen as a monolithic, technically proficient state.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, and we do toggle between these two modes where we either completely underestimate or completely are breathless and over hyped about China's, you know, technological prowess. So yeah, I it's really great to have read all that balance.
I think it goes for many of the achievements or ambitions, let's say, of Chinese government and of Chinese local governments. We forget that a lot of the material that we consume about China is local governments or Chinese initiatives basically blowing their own trumpet. They're telling the state media in China, look at our achievements, they're so great, we're going to be able to control all of this by 2025 or whenever. These are the ambitions. And too often, as I think happened, for example, with social credit, a lot of social credit reporting, that's reported uncritically as the actual achievements of the state, But in fact, it's all PR. It is a form of propaganda to say, look at how much power we have and how effective we're being. And the stated ambitions often fall much short of reality.
Absolutely.
It's kind of like the bumper grain harvest. We all know that that story is nonsense. But when it comes to the surveillance abilities of the Chinese state, we'll believe anything.
Right.
That's very true. And that's a double standard that we should be concerned about in terms of, you know, not doing the party's propaganda for it. You know, when a local government says, look at us and our amazing social credit system that we're able to incentivize all kinds of behavior, you know, we shouldn't just swallow that whole and think that that is actually what's happening on the ground. We know that the party lies about many things. It also lies about its own achievements. On the other hand, also not to underestimate the power and control of Chinese surveillance, which even at the kind of messy and disconfigured and, you know, chaotic level it is at now, does have a huge impact on people's lives. So I think it is really about getting a clear-eyed view of China without making it much more kind of perfect than it is.
And that attitude of yours obviously is also very applicable to what you're doing now. So let's perhaps shift the discussion. I'd like to ask you first about German Chancellor Olaf Scholz's recent trip to Beijing and the many issues that his government faces, from Costco's acquisition of just under a quarter of the port of Hamburg to technology exports to human rights issues. As I understand it, there's quite some division in German political circles now about China. One example we recently looked at in our coverage of the Scholz visit was how Chancellor Scholz seems more interested in engagement with China, perhaps, than his colleague, the president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, who called for Germany to reduce lopsided dependencies wherever we can in the wake of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And he particularly called out China. I should remind our American listeners that the chancellor has the real power, not the president. But it seemed to me a good illustration of Germany's political dilemma. And then, of course, you have the German companies, including Volkswagen, which has a plant in Xinjiang, which its former CEO defended, and BMW, which just announced new investments of billions of dollars into electric vehicle plants in China. So how would you characterize the China debate in German elite political and business circles?
Well, firstly, one thing to emphasize is that the German government is, of course, a coalition government, the so-called traffic light coalition. So Scholz has to balance lots of different concerns, you know, with his coalition partners who may not be on the same page as him personally and even within his own party. And what I think is really interesting within German politics is how all parties, and I think we've seen this to some extent in the UK and in the US, it's all parties, not just one, that have moved significantly more to the hawkish direction about China. One example I'd like to give is the Free Democratic Party, the FDP, who is often historically been the free trade party. So in, you know, in historical terms, they would be pro unlimited trade with China and, you know, anti anything that might mean with withdrawal from that. Now, they, over the last few years, have also become much more concerned about lack of reciprocity in trade, because now their view is not so much that free trade means anybody can sell anything to anyone, but also, you know, what are you getting from them in return? And do they also allow you the same market access? So in Germany, the most pro-free trade party has now become pretty skeptical about the terms in which Germany trades with China. And I think that's really indicative of a broader set of concerns about reciprocity and equality in the trading relationship with China. Now, in terms of Scholz's trip to China, which came very shortly after the party congress, which again, once more crowned President Xi as party leader for a third term and instilled many of his own yes men even more solidly into the government and got rid of any opposition there could have been to his policies. There was a concern, I think, among German parliamentarians that the optics and the timing of Scholz's visit were really off. Why go for less than a day, be surrounded by a COVID bubble that means that you can't really engage with most people face to face, have meetings that have to be done over a video call because of that, and all this you know, for what? And I was quite sympathetic to those concerns, and particularly to the lack of coordination at a European level of what the first European leader visiting Beijing after the pandemic would say. And, you know, there's been reporting in the Politico about this, about how Macron, the French president, had also approached Scholz and tried to negotiate joint messages and a joint meeting. And apparently, according to Politico, Scholz went on regardless. Now, I think that says a lot more about European, a weakness of European unity than anything else. In fact, I think the meeting that Scholz had and the points that he put across were well made, and the obviously the prioritized discussion of the war in Ukraine, and President Xi, even according to China's own state media readouts, which are generally obviously much more watered down than the other parties' readouts, even they said, you know, we do not see Russia's threat of nuclear war as an appropriate thing to be threatening. And of course, we're completely opposed to nuclear war. This is just in the days after Russia was amplifying its rhetoric about there being a threat of a dirty bomb attack from Ukraine, thus opening its own, you know, path to justify nuclear war in Ukraine. So I think given the actual meetings that happened, the points that Scholz made, I think that they were brave and necessary. But everything that led up to the trip, I can completely see why he annoyed many members of his own government with it.
So would you say that the kind of attitudinal shift that you personally saw, you know, sort of the problems running up to the meeting, the problems of the optics of the meeting itself, and then the fruit that it seems to have borne, would you say that that shift was sort of shared among the sort of, you know, German press, among the German chattering classes?
I think for some, yes, certainly for some of the kind of China policy think tank folks, they, you know, they saw the results. And of course, Ukraine is still a much higher priority for the German public than almost anything to do with China on in terms of China itself. It has been really complicated, though. I mean, the response has been complicated by the various different approvals and blockages of foreign investment that happened in the days just up to and after the trip. So I think the approval, for example, of COSCO, the China shipping company, to buy a minority stake in one of the container terminals at the port of Hamburg, that kind of in some ways overshadowed the trip, and people I think are still pretty mad about it sometimes in the German media, and was seen as a concession that was made to make the trip easier.
This shift in German attitudes has really kind of closely paralleled shifts that we've seen in the Anglosphere as well, you know, with popular opinion. If you look at the Pew Global Surveys, Global Attitude Surveys, it's very clearly shifting in the same direction. When I've talked to Chinese diplomats about this phenomenon and sort of pushed them on the same, you know, look, it doesn't seem to be just the United States. Could it be that something that China is doing in the world is making, you know, much of the developed world really, really, you know, turning them against China, as it were. They've always said, no, this just speaks to the discursive power of the American media and how America can still bully Europe and how the Europeans don't have any meaningful strategic autonomy yet. What's your sense of this? Do you think that there's anything to that, or do you think that Germany, for its own reasons, has sort of moved in that direction?
You know, simple explanations are the most persuasive. And so it's much simpler, I think, for Chinese observers to describe the entire of Europe's foreign policy as being US driven, because then you basically have one explanation for like a bunch of countries.
Sure.
And I do see that that attitude more broadly, for example, among Chinese friends of mine when we talk about the West, and I talk about being a European journalist, sooner or later they'll end up talking about American journalism rather, you know, and or American journalists in China. And so, you know, being a European journalist, I think, is also being somewhat in the middle of that discussion of US and China. So certainly, you know, the US and people in the US and people in China see the world as being either mono or bipolar in terms of power between the US and China, and Europe is kind of nowhere to be seen. So I completely, I see where that kind of psychology. I definitely recognize that psychology that you're describing.
The thing that that's always fascinated me about looking at China from the European perspective is that for at least a long time, it was possible to see sort of a developed world perspective that was free of that kind of obsession with national security. So you could see kind of a less tainted view of China. And, you know, there were still obviously a lot of problems, but they were kind of separated from national security. But it doesn't seem to be that way anymore, especially if you look at the UK, right? I mean, where now national security seems to be Very much on everyone's lips. And that's why...
Can we put that into a question? And, you know, looking beyond Germany to the whole European Union and the UK post-Brexit, are European countries at all of one mind with respect to United States tech policies toward China? And you have already mentioned that the European Union isn't very unified when it comes to China, but specifically about technology policies and the America's attitude. How have the Europeans responded to American efforts to enlist them, you know, the Huawei sanctions, the entity lists related to Xinjiang, and now the foreign direct product rule that was announced in October?
Oh, gosh. So I think the tech sanctions on China and U.S. unilateral sanctions in any domain are one thing that get up the backs of European partners, because they know that they will take the hit, their companies will take the hit in one of their biggest export markets for policies that they effectively have no control over. And an example of this from a few years ago, when the original Huawei sanctions were being formulated, reportedly the US went to the Wassenaar Agreement countries, which is a military civil dual use agreement of Europe, convention of European countries. They have to agree by consensus. The US presented its proposal of Huawei sanctions. People didn't agree. It's a consensus organization. It's quite common that people don't agree. And then the US went ahead and did it anyway. And now that has led to a further discussion about, you know, how do we agree these military sanctions? Do we need consensus? How do we formulate a better way of discussing these issues with the US? But it has seemed that, you know, no matter what mechanism it is, whether it's consensus or majority, in the end, the US does get its way by unilaterally issuing them anyway. So obviously the discussion of how Europe comes to agree on sanctions is almost, you know, less important than the fact that the US just really, really wants them. Now, with the foreign product rule sanctions, you're referring there to the recent swathe of sanctions limiting what chip-related technologies can be sold to China.
Right.
And thus limiting China's future chip development. Now, again, there were background discussions with European partners, also with East Asian partners like Japan and South Korea, because those are where the major companies reside. And the world's, in some ways, one of the world's most important companies for the chip supply chain lies in Netherlands. It's called ASML, and it produces the machines that engrave the circuit patterns onto chips.
Right.
And that company obviously is hugely exposed to the China market, roughly, I think, about a tenth or more of its sales by now. And that company also has a big interest in exactly, you know, what is the limit of what can be sold, what counts as advanced chips that cannot be sold, and so on. So there have been discussions within the European between European partners and the US. And the problem is those discussions are always going to be pretty one-sided, because in the end, the US will decide, and it will decide how much pain it's willing to inflict on its partners. So I think I do sense a lot of discontent with how trading partners are treated as a result of these sanctions.
Right. The American Commerce Department also entity listed quite a number of Chinese companies that were associated with surveillance in Xinjiang. And I want to turn a little bit to Xinjiang because, you know, several national parliaments in European countries, I believe the European Parliament itself have since 2017 used very, very strong language about the repression of Uyghurs in Xinjiang. Have they basically been on board with the American responses, broadly speaking? And has the EU response been unanimous, or are there cracks in that too?
I think at this point there is pretty much consensus within the EU on the moral problem of Xinjiang and the human rights atrocities there, particularly following the UN report from the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, which stated that these atrocities could amount to crimes against humanity, and which reconfirmed the previous reports we've been hearing and writing about mass incarceration, about forced labor transfers, and also about the huge slump in fertility, and raised the question of whether there was forced sterilization. The next question is what to do about it, and certainly Uyghur human rights activists have been trying to bring legislation and bring campaigns to stop countries from importing goods made with slave labor from the Xinjiang region. And there is a There are various directives and bills on this going through both the European Parliament and national governments. And what looks like is going to happen is that the European Parliament is going to come up with a market monitoring instrument. So unlike the US measure, which blocks imports from the region and is about kind of protecting what goes into the country, this is more about this measure will be more consumer focused. So it'd be that anybody in the European Union who has evidence to suspect that the goods that they've bought within the EU have been made with slave labor, then they can bring cases against companies, and that would also include slave labor within the EU. So it's not so much about imports and exports; it's about forced labor, and it's about selling forced labor goods within the EU, and that would also include forced labor from Xinjiang.
Right. So it's not technically country specific, although Xinjiang was clearly the impetus for this.
Yeah, exactly.
Great. So we've talked about Huawei, the foreign direct product rule. There's the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS and Science Act. And of course, as you've hinted at, although these measures are aimed at China, they have consequences for Europe. So what does it look like right now if you're a German company with big export markets in both China and the United States, and you're feeling all of this political pressure over your supply chains?
Yeah, I was in Germany a couple of months ago and I met a lot of the business associations in Berlin and Frankfurt. And one of them, which is the VDMA, the Association of Machinery Makers, they described how for their members, many were really caught in the middle of US sanctions on the one hand and Chinese suspicion and domestic self-sufficiency drives on the other hand, and were creating three separate supply chains, like kind of triplicate supply chains.
Wow.
One for China, which doesn't include US products because the Chinese customers are worried that one day they might not be able to get hold of US products. They don't see that as a stable supply chain. And one for the US, which doesn't include Chinese products because of security concerns from the US side. And the third one for Europe, where it's like, yeah, throw everything in and mix it all around. And what's really surprising to me is that those companies have already very much already doing this and making plans to do this further in order to shore up the security of their supply chains. I think this kind of action also highlights how what might start off as a national security concern or a cybersecurity concern for the US, then become, for example, in the case of the Huawei sanctions, then becomes like a supply chain security, economic and business concern for Europe and for the rest of the world. Because these sanctions from the US just fall from the sky from the point of view of a German company. They have to be as prepared for a new swathe of sanctions on high-end technology as much as they have for the COVID disruptions on supply chain and slow logistics in China. These are parts of the geopolitical weather they cannot control. And so the way that they can try to control them a little bit is to diversify their supply chains around the world. Now, that's really hugely costly for many companies. And as a result, the small and in many circumstances, it's the small and medium enterprises in Germany, the Mittelstand, as they're called, and much highly valued as a force for economic growth within Germany, who find it much more tough to survive in this geopolitical uncertainty and in the current economic climate, and the big companies that are still successfully investing and profiting from China.
Fascinating. So are they putting any kind of political pressure? Are they trying to sort of lobby through Berlin or through Brussels to try to get Washington to soften a little on that?
That's a very good question. I get the impression that businesses already think that the U.S. sanction system is going to carry on rolling. So that's not been the focus of their lobbying. Yeah. Opposing sanctions from the U.S. is also much more of a feels much more morally dubious for German companies who might agree with some of the principles behind the sanctions, but not agree with the extent of the sanctions, etc.
I mean, sanctions are always a difficult thing to get your head around. I mean, I grew up in apartheid South Africa when we had sanctions. And, I am very sympathetic to the argument that the sanctions simply reinforce the kind of what we used to call a lager mentality, like, the ox draw inside the ox wagons, and that the the white government you almost used it as a propaganda about the total onslaught of the rest of the world attacking us, and that the people who really suffered were, you know, poorer black South Africans. You know, that's an argument that people used to make, and it's
and they still make in China, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. But were they effective? Because I think the South Africa sanctions over apartheid are held up as the standard for effective sanction regimes.
They are, but I always point out that apartheid only collapsed when the Cold War ended and America stopped being interested in funding proxy wars in Southern Africa against communist governments. For me, that was a much more, that is the big reason, that's the timing, that's why apartheid ended, was because the Cold War ended and it was not going to be any more backing for South Africa. But this is a whole different show.
I agree with you on the difficulty of sanctions regimes. Even in Xinjiang, for example, the Xinjiang economy has tanked, I mean, as a result, partly of the security lockdown. It's simply very difficult to do trade and business when you can't even go into a shopping center without having all of your bags scanned and your ID taken, right? And Han Chinese business people have, you know, fled away from that region because of the lack of business opportunities. And the only group of people who cannot leave the tanking economy are Uyghurs and ethnic Muslim minorities who cannot leave. So there is a huge issue around what is the efficacy of sanctions. On the other hand, I agree, like, consumers should be able to A, know whether their products are made with slave labor, and B, choose not to buy products that
make moral choices. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Speaking of moral choices, so for Americans watching what's happened in Ukraine since February 24th, there's been this understandable impulse to immediately draw parallels between Russia, Ukraine to China, Taiwan. Have you seen anything like that happening among Europeans? And maybe what, broadly speaking, have European attitudes toward China and its pro-Russian neutrality stance, what have those attitudes been like? Has it badly damaged China's standing in Europe?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when I was in China, which is at the start of the outbreak of war, I would hear about, I would hear from afar concerns in Europe whether this was going to repeat itself with China and Taiwan. And I was thinking, is this the case of, only the most pessimistic views get amplified in the media, and therefore I'm hearing all these, doomsday scenarios. When I came back to Europe and started interviewing companies here, those were the scenarios they would bring up to me without me even mentioning Taiwan. Wow. I would say, what are your concerns for the future trade outlook with China? Taiwan is very much up there, even without me putting it on the agenda. Yeah. And I think that's partly because of the narrative of dependency, for example, on Russian energy in particular, that is really dominant in European discussions about trade right now. There's a whole question of how will Europe continue to fuel itself over the winter, and how did Europe allow itself to become so dependent on a country that was clearly not an ally for energy? And I think that's why the question of dependency is then being transposed onto China and Taiwan, not just in the event of an invasion of Taiwan disrupting supply chains and so on, but also in the event of deterioration of the political climate in China, of relationships with Europe and so on. What else are we dependent on China for? I think the state of this conversation is very frustrating for me right now, because I'm the kind of person who likes to see not just a list of complaints with what's wrong with the status quo, but some searching for a vision for how things might be in the future. And right now we have a lot of cons on the list of what are the possible scenarios in which trade links with China will be disrupted. But I don't see a coherent economic vision for what less or different trade with China would look like. And quite quickly, that will be the future that we slip into, just because of the force of current economic, not even political, forces at play. And so I think we need to understand, what does European growth that's not propelled by Chinese exports and Chinese growth look like?
So it sounds to me like you don't think there's much chance that the Europe-China Comprehensive Agreement on Investment will be revived. And so that was, if I'm
anyone, I don't think there's anyone who thinks there's much chance of the CAI being revived. But
that basically died in 2021, right? That was when it was supposedly going to be ratified in 2020, 2021, and then it kind of died on the vine.
Yeah. Well, the EU's position on that is so long as there are Chinese sanctions against European parliamentarians, which there still are because of the kind of back and forth sanctions over human rights abuses in Xinjiang, then the CAI will not pass through parliament so long as there are members of parliament that are still sanctioned. So I think that is a standoff. I don't think either side is interested enough in the CAI in itself to revive it.
Hmm. On a different topic, what is the European reaction to the meeting between Xi Jinping and Joe Biden in Bali been like? Are the Europeans feeling a little relieved that we're not about to go to war, or what are the optics?
I think it's obviously good that President Xi is now back on the international speaking circuit. And in addition to meeting with the German leader, has also met with the leaders of the US, France, Japan, and so on. And that in itself, I think, offers reassurance that face-to-face meetings can do a lot more than phone calls, which were all that we had over the last 3 years when President Xi was self-isolating along with most of the Chinese leadership. But it really is this kind of the start of the engagement, you know, rather than the conclusion. So I think, you know, there's no kind of great heartening conclusions to be drawn yet. I will say that both the Chinese state media readouts and the foreign side, so, you know, the US or the French or whatever readouts, which are often usually very different because they emphasize completely different things, and the Chinese ones, I'm sure, are much less complete. You know, but both sides' accounts of what happened at those bilateral meetings try to be quite positive and diplomatic about areas of cooperation, even with the US, which strikes quite a different tone to the tone of Chinese media in general about the US-China relationship. So it's a bit like you can be quite, if you're a Chinese media commentator, you can be quite hawkish and quite nationalistic up until your president actually meets with the president of the US, in which case you have to then echo like the kind of diplomatic and, you know, win-win type both sides messaging of that, which I think is actually a good restraint on Chinese media discourse.
Yeah, I totally agree. So China has never made a secret of its hopes to see Europe really emerge as a kind of strategically autonomous pole in a multipolar configuration of geopolitics, right?
I think Europe has that ambition too, no? I think people here are pretty on board with that.
but I think, you know, I mean, if you look at what's happened since February 24th, I mean, you know, look, prior to that, I think you're absolutely right. You know, European leaders were not happy about having to make a choice between Beijing and Washington. But, you know, since February 24th, I mean, I think anyone recognizes that even if this winter gets really cold, there may be cracks, but there's not going to be gigantic fissures between, you know, in the transatlantic alliance system, right? It's not going to be a total rupture. I mean, so if I were in Beijing and I were looking at this and nurturing hopes, you know, that Europe might become more meaningfully autonomous, I guess I would pin my hopes on 2024. I would be thinking, gosh, all the European capitals must be looking at that race and thinking, oh my God, if another Trump or even, you know, DeSantis sort of Trump light comes into office, you know, what's going to happen to American support for Ukraine? What's going to happen to tariffs on European goods? So I wonder what these scenarios look like right now when viewed from European capitals.
You know, the departure of Trump and the advent of Biden has done great things for the, you know, optimism from Europe in transatlantic partnerships.
Right.
But I do think that there is a broader concern around the stability of that partnership. You know, even without Trump right now, he will run for office again, you know, regardless of how likely that is. There is a threat, basically, I think, that the EU has been burnt by the Trump presidency, and that will last a lot longer than Trump's, you know, own influence on politics does, because it highlights how fickle the American partnership can be under a change of president. I think that the Ukraine war has, of course, brought together the rest of Europe and united it in tackling a common enemy, and that is something I think that the Chinese are trying to grapple with and trying to understand. And almost, I think there's almost, I think, an attitude in Beijing of, you know, wariness about the about the durability of European unity over Ukraine. One scholar was telling me about how there are now Chinese diplomats visiting European countries, not to have formal meetings with their opposite sides, but to gather information on essentially like how far the European Unity Project can go, how disgruntled are the Europeans in this, you know, at the start of this long winter that's ahead of us, almost as if to try and test the hypothesis that Europe will eventually, you know, despite the unity now, that Europe will eventually crumble because of its problems with imports of energy and grain and so on.
Right.
So
right.
Certainly China is holding its breath for the European Unity Project to fall apart.
And are the Europeans hedging at all? I mean, are they sort of reluctant to burn bridges with China in case the GOP does come back into power in 2024?
I don't think that people see it as playing the US off against China, or China as kind of an insurance policy against the US, because China cannot help Europe in terms of, you know, security and defense in sure. the US. I don't think that they're comparative in that way. It's more that there are like two really hard realities going on. One is that many European economies, although not all, Lithuania is not that dependent on China, are very much tied to China's growth. And those economies, you know, exports have already taken a hit because of the COVID economic slowdown in China and so on. So that's already a point that's in crisis right now. I wouldn't say this is anticipation of a future crisis. I think economically, the crisis of trade with China has already arrived for Europe. And then on the other hand, there are the rise of China in terms of new energy vehicles, in terms of green technology, has also caused both the EU and the US to say, okay, we need to think about our own industrial policy and we need to think about our own technological leadership. And that has led to policies like the Inflation Reduction Act, in part, which tries to increase US domestic innovation in certain green sectors, including in electric vehicles. Now, that then creates a situation where Europe is like, well, China has industrial strategy, the US has an industrial strategy. Do we need an industrial strategy? And there has been, you know, there's been a resurgence of industrial strategy, which for a long time was a taboo for free marketers in the European Union.
The 90s are truly dead, huh? Mm-hmm. Let's move to the United Kingdom and talk about the new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. And as I understand it, during the course of his business and political life, he hasn't been particularly consistent on China. He has in the past advocated for stronger trade ties. But at least since he first tried to become Prime Minister, when he was competing with Liz Truss, he jumped on the get tough on China bandwagon very quickly. This week, his tone on China seemed to soften again. What do you make of him and where he might take UK-China relations?
So the get tough on China bandwagon is, I would say, like the easiest bandwagon to jump on. It's moving very slowly. There's not much of a barrier to entry. You can just get on it without any expertise.
Just walk onto it.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a very open access bandwagon. So I, you know, genuinely, I think that's part of the reason why China from a few years ago, almost being not really mentioned in parliamentary politics in the UK, has become such a topic of discussion and debate in almost every Foreign Affairs Committee meeting. China will come up. I think the social dynamics of this is quite interesting as well, because for a long time, obviously, the relationship with the EU was the foreign policy issue that dominated British politics. And after the Brexit referendum, there's been a huge kind of reconfiguration within the Conservative Party. You know, half of it was pro-Brexit, half of which was anti-Brexit, of, you know, what would the new foreign policy stance look like? And is there a foreign policy that we can agree on, given how much our party disagrees on internally about the European Union? So it turns out, yes, there is a policy that everyone can agree on, not just within the Conservative Party, but more widely, which is the China bashing bandwagon. So that, I think, because of the amount of consensus on China's skepticism within the government, it's become very much a during the Conservative leadership debate earlier this year, became a kind of one-upmanship competition between Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak, the two contenders who each had their turn, in fact, in becoming prime minister for a short while. So that's, I think that describes a bit why Sunak seems inconsistent in retrospect, because of tacking kind of much more to the right in terms of China hawkishness during the leadership hustings. There are obviously legitimate concerns behind the hawkishness that's appeared. And in some ways, it's almost like the UK is catching up for, you know, a decade of being quite complacent about its relationship with China by having like this kind of really concentrated 3 months of China skepticism.
Make up for the failed golden era under David Cameron.
Yeah. Oh, poor yeah. David Cameron. Yeah. Yuan, this has been fantastic. I want you to ask, actually, Yuan, this has been fantastic. I want you to talk about the new book that you're working on, which I understand is about social mobility in the post-80s generation, I guess the rough equivalent of China's millennials. Tell us about that insofar as you are able.
Yes, this is the manuscript that I've handed in July.
Oh, great.
I started my current role as Europe-China correspondent, and we're in the great old revisions process right now. And it'll be published probably in early 2024 by Bloomsbury in the UK and Penguin Viking in the US. As you mentioned, it's about it's broadly about social mobility for the post-80s and 90s generation, i.e. my generation, i.e. the generation that grew up after the reform and opening up period, that witnessed both the boom and then the slowdown of the capitalist experiment in China, which is still, I would say, an experiment. The impetus behind the book partly was to capture certain stories of women I got to know very well while I was based in China for 6 years. And you know, among my friendship group in Beijing and in other parts of China, I've seen quite amazing stories of mobility, you know, both rises and falls of people born into pretty extreme poverty in the 80s or 90s, who then made it to the capital, of people who were born into middle class city life, and then who gave it away for political reasons. And so it is about social mobility, but it's not a book written as a kind of economics text. It's a book written more like a novel, and it follows these women's lives in a narrative style across their lives.
Well, I hope we will be your first stop once you get the book published, and that you'll come back on a program to talk about it. And I really look forward to reading it. I'm sure it'll be great.
Thank you. I hope so too.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk. Just really looking forward to that book. And do you have a working title for it yet?
The title is Private Revolutions.
Ah, I like that. Private Revolutions. Really good.
That's layered, a very layered.
Indeed, indeed. So let's move on to recommendations. But first, Jeremy, give us a plug.
All right. My appeal is very simple. If you like this podcast, please subscribe to the China Project Access to get an ad-free version of this show every Monday, 4 days before the public release. Your ears will thank you for it. You will also get access to all of our other great content and our newsletters.
Yay. Yay. All right. Let's move on to recommendations. Jeremy, why don't you start?
Sure. So this week, Dave Chappelle, the comedian, has been in a bit of trouble for some remarks he made on Saturday Night Live about Jews. And I just want to recommend, if you want to hear some really rude things about Jews, there's this incredible comedy special by Ari Shaffir,
who grew up
as an Orthodox Jew. And it's simply called Jew, and it's free on YouTube, and it's wonderful.
Yeah, right. So anti-Semitism originating from Jewish people is okay, huh? Is
it's
that what you're
not
saying?
Actually anti-Semitism. Know, it's called humor.
I'm sure it's fine. It meets with your half-Jew approval. So, okay. All right. His name is Ari Shaffir, you said?
Yes.
All right. We'll check it out. I will. Yuan, what do you have for us?
Can I have two recommendations, or is there anyone?
Absolutely. No, two's fine.
Two recommendations. Yeah. Okay, so one piece of music. Emily Wells is an American composer and multi-instrumentalist, and she is currently on her European tour to play her most recent album called Regards to the End. She is a really kind of multi-genre composer, so I find it very difficult to summarize what she does. It's like a mixture of kind of orchestral pop, R&B, and all of it is done by her solely. So when she's performing on stage, which I saw a couple of weeks ago in London, she's playing the violin, singing, looping herself, playing the keyboard, and even playing her own drums to kind of weave this super kind of multi-layered music, and wow. her kind of early career was as a classical violinist, and she's now, I guess, producing more, I guess, in the pop genre. But it's incredibly satisfying to listen to, because it just feels like there's so many, you know, it feels like it awakens you on many, many different layers. I think she's just an amazing composer. So that's a musical recommendation. Her name is Emily Wells.
Fantastic.
And my book recommendation is going to be a classic of science fantasy, and that's Ursula Le Guin.
Yeah.
I recently read The Dispossessed, which is about, well, it's partly about interplanetary travel. It's also about two different planets with two different civilizations. Very broadly, you can call one a communist and one capitalist, and about a scientist who travels from one to the other and starts to realize that the kind of home truths that they grew up with in their own country, in their own civilization, about what capitalism or communism meant, are completely different to what they find in the other country.
Oh, great. I mean, I love the Earthsea trilogy. I haven't read Dispossessed yet. I'll put it on my list right away.
Yeah, so these are more like Earthsea I also really love, but so like in Ursula Le Guin's more like adult fiction, there's the series that includes The Dispossessed. And she has a lot of adult fiction, although, you know, who are we to question the line between children's and adult fiction?
That's what I always say. Yeah, I mean, I don't like this whole, that's just a YA novel. My other recommendation, actually I'm saving it for another show that I'm taping later, is for something that's sometimes dismissed as YA, but is actually just a great novel. So thanks. Those are great recommendations. Emily Wells, I'll definitely check her out too. She sounds fantastic. I have two recommendations as well. One is a website and one is a TV series. The website is called mongulai.com, mongulai.com. It's an e-commerce site where you can buy all sorts of artisanal crafts and other products made in Mongolia. Wolf tail fur hats and Mongolian boots, both of which I just recently purchased.
Are you becoming a cosplayer, Kaiser?
Yeah, I thought something like that. And a deal. I got a deal on a deal. DEEL, you know, those Mongolian traditional garbs. This one looks really cool. It'll keep me warm in the winter. Traditional belts and quivers and bow cases and saddles, and even they've got like yurts or gares.
Kaiser, I think you're one of the few Americans who can pull off this look.
I think I can. I'm pretty sure I can. I've done it before. The bows that are on sale, by the way, don't buy those. I asked around, and it sounds like they're terrible. I don't recommend those. But the rest of the stuff looks great. I have this great pair of boots that I got that came from them. It's mongulai.com. Check it out. My other recommendation is for a show on Netflix called Barbarians. In German, it's Barbarian. Are you maybe detecting a theme here, Jeremy? This is actually about the
a middle-aged man cosplaying a Hun. Yeah, I get it.
This is actually about
some people buy Ferraris.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm just like LARPing or something like that. This is actually about the Germanic tribes fighting Roman expansion in the time of Tiberius. So the first season is actually focused on the German leader Arminius, who just has the most amazing story. I remember reading about him when I was young. He was sent as a hostage to Rome in his early childhood and grew up in Rome kind of as a Roman, but then went back and then ended up leading the German tribes in that very famous battle of Teutoburg Forest, where they ambushed a couple of legions, actually, under Varus, and they completely wiped them out. And then the second season, that's where it culminates in this Teutoburg Forest battle. So the second season is about sort of the Romans pushing back under Germanicus. So I actually pulled out my old copy of Tacitus and was checking about Germanicus. It's a lot of fun. It's an amazing period of history. One thing that I really loved about it is that the Germans speak German. That's not surprising. But the Romans speak Latin. I mean, it's all subtitled, of course, but they speak Latin. And it's kind of amazing. I've never seen that in a show before. So
one of the few instances of employment for a live Latin interpreter.
Exactly right. I mean, they get a bunch of priests, but it's really cool. It's really cool. Check it out. I just finished it last night, the second season. Very, very good. All right. Thanks so much, Jeremy. Great to see you again.
Yeah, likewise. And thank you, Jan. That was fascinating.
Yeah, Jan, thank you so much. That was really fantastic. Thanks.
Thank you for having me on.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by the China Project and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced and edited by me, Kaiser Guo. We would be delighted if you would drop us an email at seneca@thechinaproject.com or just give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts, as this really does help people discover the show. Meanwhile, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at @thechinaproj, and be sure to check out all the shows in the Seneca Network. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Take care.